Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, featuring unique shopping and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackanddrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am absolutely thrilled at the opportunity to speak with the co-authors of a beautiful and brilliantly conceived new book called Hollywood, Her Story, An Illustrated History of Women and the Movies. And I think most people who, like me, love the movies but are not thoroughly versed in the history of the film industry will be astounded at how rich a history we are talking about, and how at certain points in the history of film, women have played a tremendously crucial role, and not just in the ways that we immediately think of, but often behind the scenes, often behind the camera, playing very, very crucial roles in the film industry. It has not always been the case, of course, and for long periods of time, it has been a struggle for women to be viable players in the film industry, but there have been times when they have enjoyed tremendous success and influence, and it's of course a time now when some of those gains are being regained, although there is still much work to be done. At any rate, this book has been put together in meticulous fashion by the two authors whom I'm going to be speaking with today, Jill Teigen, who is an author, speaker, and an electrical engineer, and the co-author of a book called Her Story, A Timeline of the Women Who Changed America, and Barbara Bridges, who is a founder of Women and Film in partnership with the Denver Film Society. And they have brought together their respective areas of expertise to put together this wonderful book published by Lions Press, a division of Roman and Littlefield, again titled Hollywood, Her Story, An Illustrated History of Women and the Movies. Jill Teigen and Barbara Bridges, we welcome you both to the morning show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
I'm really excited about this. I think we need to begin by hearing a little bit about some breakfasts that you enjoyed together, and a really important breakfast that ended up being, it sounds like, the catalyst for this collaboration between the two of you. Maybe tell us a little bit about how the two of you knew each other, and then about that that critically important breakfast meeting in which the idea of this book was born.
I'll let Barbara take this part. This is Jill.
Well, we're not really quite sure how we met. We knew each other maybe through the Women's Foundation or things like that, but we occasionally would have breakfast together and talk about various things. And as you mentioned, Jill had a book called Her Story, and one day she said, well, my second in this series is going to be about women in Africa, and I just immediately, without thinking, responded, oh, it should be about women in the movies. And she said, okay. And so there it was, right there, without any further thought. And from that day on, we have been meeting at a library, in a little room in a library, for really 4 years now, at least once a week or more, depending on where the book was in its development.
I described your collaboration as one in which you come to this particular project, that is, this book, with, in a sense, contrasting areas of expertise, with, of course, some overlap as well. But maybe you could spell that out for us.
Well, it's so interesting. This is Jill. I was
doing these books and working on thinking about books about women in history. And so I, as you mentioned in the introduction, am an electrical engineer. I am very good at the research part, putting the spreadsheets together that are the underlay for the book, finding out, rooting out the pieces of information. But really, what Barbara and I do so well together is that we're so complementary with her knowledge of the movie industry, my knowledge of technology and women's history and history in general, that it really makes for a good partnership.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really stunning book. It's a great accomplishment to what you have done here. I wonder if you could take us inside that process of research and also the process of kind of sorting out kind of the dimensions of this story. I mean, just how vast and broad and deep a story it was, despite the fact that at a glance it would seem that that women have not played a big role in film industry. In fact, that's not true at all. How much did you know at the outset that that was not true, and that in fact this was a richly complex story that was not going to be all that easy to tell?
I'm not sure that we knew what all we were going to discover whenever we started our research. We took the different parts of filmmaking and researched all the women that contributed to each part. For example, we would research the cinematographers. We would research the directors, things like that. And we would get long lists of women who were possibilities to be in the book. And then we would go through and decide who would be in the book, who would not, and what years we would put them in, because this book is divided as a timeline through the decades. So putting the different women in the different years was a real journey that we had. It took us a long time to do that. So once we had that picture, then we were able to see what you are describing in that overarching story, which I will say is that women helped found the movie industry. And women were early filmmakers and owned studios and developed many of the filmmaking techniques that have been developed over the years. And they thrived in the silent film era. So we were so surprised that the 1910s in our book is the longest chapter in the book. And then the story goes on through the studio system and the modern day. So we learned all of this as we were putting it together.
It's I was astounded as well that it is in many respects the early phase of the film industry that is the richest and certainly full of the most surprises, and we'll explore that in just a moment. I want to be sure to compliment you on something. I would hate to forget about this as we get rolling in kind of the heart of the book, and that is the fact that as we read this book, it is peppered with all kinds of other landmarks in terms of the history of film that have nothing at least directly or specifically to do with women in the film industry, but just important things for us to know in terms of understanding kind of the sweep of history in terms of the film industry overall. I really think that's a valuable addition to this book. I'm so glad that that is part of it. Can you maybe enlighten us on why you made that decision to include that kind of information, at least here and there, through the course of the book?
Well, it's exactly what you just said, and that is, if you don't have an understanding of what was happening in the industry as a whole at the time, then you don't truly understand the women's accomplishments at that time either. And so I'm looking at some of the earlier years, and there's a description of what a cutter is, which is what we know today as an editor. But in the beginning, they literally were cutting the frames and pasting them together with tape. I mean, it really was cutting and pasting, not the way we do it now. And knowing when the studios were founded, and there's a wonderful quote in here about the animators, the inkers who worked in the Walt Disney Studio, and what their work was like, and how hard they worked, and all of those kinds of things, which really then adds what in television we would call the necessary color to the rest of the story.
We're speaking with Jill Teachin and Barbara Bridges about their book, Hollywood, Her Story, An Illustrated History of Women and the Movies. So, probably one of the most amazing statements in the entire book comes in, I believe, the preface or introduction, when you write, "Women virtually controlled the film industry during the silent film era." That is to say that women were very much involved in every single aspect of the film industry. And in certain phases or certain components of the film industry, women were the dominant force. Before we talk about some of the specific extraordinary women who were part of this early history of the film industry, do you have any theories on why this was the case? Why women were so important in the film industry at a time when in so many other ventures and aspects of modern society, women were very much marginalized and limited in their role? Why was that not also true of the film industry at this time?
Well, I think that at that time in filmmaking, there wasn't necessarily the kind of money involved in movies, as we see as the story goes along, in the late 1920s when money hit the movie industry. So here we have a time when it was just open to everyone. It was open to men and women. But we see that the women were just so, as they still are today, so talented and so creative. And they just had that opportunity. We use the word opportunity quite a lot to describe so many of the aspects where they had the opportunity or didn't throughout this book. And that was a time just totally open to the opportunities of so many of these wonderfully talented women.
Hmm. I was especially astounded to read that for much of the era of silent films, you tell us women screenwriters outnumbered male screenwriters 10-1. I would just never have imagined such a thing could possibly be true.
It really is amazing that there were so many screenwriters. Actually, women have excelled in screenwriters from the beginning, pretty much all the way through today. And to the question that we just were discussing, in 1917, we feature a screenwriter whose name was Beulah Marie Dix. And she says, in the early days, it was all very informal. Anybody on the set did anything he or she was called on to do. She was a screenwriter, but she says she's walked on as an extra. I tended lights, and anybody not doing anything else wrote down the director's notes on the script. I also spend a great deal of time in the cutting room. To Barbara's point, before it became unionized, before there was a lot of money involved, when people were just learning, this was such the infancy of the film industry, and everyone was welcome. Interestingly, later on, at the onset of the computer age, as we know now from the movie Hidden Figures and other books related to that, women were welcomed and were very important in the early years of that industry as well, as compared to how it's evolved to where women are not very active and are actually not very encouraged and not very welcome in that industry. So there are parallels in other industries as well.
Before we again start talking about a few specifics, one of the things that you mention about this era of the film industry, this era of its history, is the fact that so many silent films are lost. I mean, the physical films themselves have disintegrated long ago, or were discarded as of no value, especially once talking films sort of took over the landscape. I wonder, in addition to much of the actual work of these women having been lost, along with the work of many men as well, how difficult it was to research this phase of the film industry. I mean, how well documented is it, and how elusive was a lot of the information that you share in your book?
Well, we were able to learn about the different women, and we feel like we have documented the silent film era and the women in it, and we love talking about these women. We enjoy that part so much. You're right that a lot of these films just disintegrated. What they made the films on wasn't meant at that time to even last. Special storage had to be made, and whenever they had something that they believed was better, then they would just make shelf space, which was more valuable to them than the films that were on those shelves. So when we do get into the first filmmaker, Alice Guy Blaché, we didn't get into that part of it so much about her films being lost in the book, but in the movie about her that recently came out called Be Natural, it did get into that in her struggle to claim the movies that she made, or to say, no, I didn't make that movie. So she spent some of her later years trying to set the record straight. I made these movies. No, a man didn't make that. I did that. And so so even during that time, she was struggling with that history of movies that still existed or didn't exist.
Wow. So in other words, it's not just a matter of all these decades later, you know, the story being complicated and not told well, but or not well preserved, but even as she was living these events, it was already a struggle to make the story clear that of what she had accomplished. Tell us more about Alice Guy Blaché. She is an amazing woman, and her career in film, it sounds like, began in 1896, so nearly at the dawn of the film industry. Tell us more about what she managed to accomplish.
She was, or Barbara, do you want to go since you're so involved with the Be Natural story of Alice?
What, Jill is sending that to me because I was an co-executive producer on that movie called Be Natural. Alice Guy Blaché was our first female filmmaker, and she's a French woman. She started in France, but then she came to the United States, and she had a studio, which was, she was the first woman to have her own studio called Solax, and it was in Fort Lee, New Jersey, which was the center of filmmaking at that time, before Hollywood. So her first film was The Fairy of the Cabbages, and it was only a minute long. So you think about how long movies were at that time. She made 1,000 movies. And She experimented with so many of the special effects, running films in reverse, double exposures, things like that. So she was doing so much in film, and there she was starting in 1896. And we love her quote, just to end there, and it kind of sets the stage for the whole book. There is nothing connected with the staging of a motion picture that a woman cannot do as easily as a man, and there is no reason why she cannot completely master every technicality of the art.
Absolutely true, and one would say it goes without saying, except it's something that, of course, very much needed to be said, and needed to be said again and again. Before we move on, how would you describe, you've already hinted at the fact that even though women were very, very active in the film industry in this early period, I mean, much more than most of us would ever guess, What is your sense of what the general environment and culture was at that point? I mean, despite the fact that they were so active, were they viewed, generally speaking, as oddities? Or was it, by and large, accepted as not all that big a deal that women were playing such a significant role in the making of motion pictures at that time? I mean, was it seen mostly as normal?
Sorry, I think that because it was, there weren't rules yet, there wasn't structure yet, there weren't a lot of definitions that went into the industry. People were just really finding their way. And as we are going to discuss, the highest paid director in the silent film era was a woman. The highest paid actor, male or female, was a woman. And so it wasn't where we are today with the ideas that we have today. And what one of the things Barbara didn't say, Alice Guy Blaché was a director. She was a producer. She was a writer, and she was a cinematographer. It wasn't that she was just one or the other, or one of whatever. She was all of those things. So people were just really learning the ropes. They were establishing the industry at that time. And so I think that there were many more opportunities for women then. And remember, this is 2020. We're celebrating 100 years of women having the right to vote this year. We're talking about the 1890s, the 1910s. Women in the U.S. didn't even have the right to vote, except in certain states, at that point in time. So, yes, it was different for a woman, but the industry was much more open and much more fluid.
Hmm. And I guess that helps us understand why perhaps it was so possible for the gifted and capable women of this generation to play such a role in the industry, because in a sense, I think one of you said it was a very fluid industry, in a sense, finding its footing. And it was, you know, in some ways, kind of like the Wild West. And anybody who was capable and courageous could probably find a place in that world. And it's only when things kind of calcified and stratified with the rise of the big studios and so on, that's when the picture started to change. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I would say that's a fair assessment, because as Jill just pointed out, these women were multitasking. They were doing anything and everything that interested them or that was needed to make a movie. So there they were. They might be more known as a director or more known as an actress as opposed to studio or these kinds of things. But then when the studio system came along, everything became very structured.
As we are talking about the film industry, although one of the things that I so love about your book is it shares with us names and faces that most of us know absolutely nothing about. But there are, of course, major figures who are quite well known, and one of them would be Mary Pickford, America's sweetheart. Just explain or remind us why she is such an important figure in this history beyond her superstardom as an actress.
Well, we profile Mary Pickford in 1909, and in that year, she appeared in only 51 movies. Later, she was... remember, Barbara said, these are shorter movies. There are one reel or two reel movies, and a reel is about 15 minutes. And so they were shorter, but nevertheless, she was very busy working. She was the first movie star to own her own film company. She helped found United Artists. She controlled the creative output of her movies. She was the first actor, male or female, to become a millionaire. And she was one of the founding members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. And later she received not only a Best Actress Oscar, but an Honorary Academy Award. So she helped form the industry. She helped set all the pieces and parts in place to make the industry go.
Hmm. On the other hand, from this same era, is a name that I absolutely did not know at all, and it's a name that I think everybody who loves film should know, especially anybody who loves the work and admires the work of Charlie Chaplin. A woman by the name of Mabel Normand, who apparently was known in her day as the Queen of Comedy. And she, like so many of the other women you highlight in this period, is sort of a multi-threat, a screenwriter, an actress, a director, a producer. But I want you in particular to talk about the crucial role that she played in the marvelous films of Charlie Chaplin. From what you describe here, it sounds like Charlie Chaplin may not have been who he was or achieved what he achieved without her. Tell us more about Mabel Normand.
Well, Barbara, I'm not sure that you know, but we do show her in 1914, a screenwriter, an actress, a director, and a producer. And I'm actually going to let Barbara talk more about her, but I'm also going to say that there's a woman a little bit later on whose name is June Foray. And we know the name Mel Blanc, who did many, many voices. But it's actually said in our book that Mel Blanc was the male June Foray. June Foray did over 400 voices, including Rocky the Squirrel and many, many others. And what happens, and what happened to Mabel Normand, except for people that know about her, is that Charlie Chaplin gets all the credit, when instead Mabel should really get the credit.
Or certainly a lion's share of it, at the very least. Yes. Tell us more about what she managed to achieve and why she is such a significant figure, both in her own right and in terms of what she helped Charlie Chaplin to achieve.
Well, you can see throughout what we write that there are a lot of famous names of men who have women behind them, especially editors along the way that really make their pictures. So we have Mabel Normand, who... again, a multitasker, screenwriter, actress, director, producer, and she's called the Queen of Comedy in the silent film era. So she had her own movie studio and production company, and she appeared in films with Charlie Chaplin and Fatty Arbuckle. So she often wrote and directs, or co-wrote and co-directed Chaplin films. So she mentored Chaplin, and we have no idea about this except for in our research, it's not well known. And so many of the tramp's traits are borrowed from her and her comedy. Now, nobody would really know that without doing the research or just reading our book. So that's the kinds of things that we discover along the way in our research.
I appreciated the fact that you... tell us about a woman by the name of Jeannie McPherson, whom you tell us was Cecil B. DeMille's chief screenwriter from 1915 to 1945. I mean, it's just, first of all, it's just kind of astounding for anybody to have a distinction over the course of that long a career, especially when one thinks of how the world of movies changed so drastically from 1915 to 1945. Tell us a bit more about Jeannie McPherson and her significance on the film landscape.
Well, I'm actually going to divert for a moment while we find her, but Thelma Schoonmaker, who was just nominated for her 8th Oscar and did not receive the Oscar itself, she would have been the first person to have received 4 editing Oscars. And she has worked with Martin Scorsese for more than 50 years. So that part isn't actually unusual at all.
Oh, Thelma Schoonmaker, yes. I remember reading about her, yes.
So, you know, these alliances are formed, and Jeannie McPherson we feature in the book in 1913. So,
I suppose it's a matter of when someone is especially capable and they are a marvelous colleague and there is a beautiful and fruitful working relationship, why not allow that partnership and collaboration to continue over the course of of many decades, it only makes sense.
And that's what we find throughout the book too. We find these collaborations, like I said, especially through editing, that with Thelma Shoemaker, with Martin Scorsese, or Susan Morse with Woody Allen, that kind of a thing. Susan Menke with Quentin Tarantino. They just find people that they can really work with, and then they make the films together.
By the way, I think it would be interesting to know, since we've talked on a couple of occasions already about screenwriters and the work that they do, to maybe hear a little bit about what screenwriting meant in the silent film era versus what screenwriting was when we had talking pictures. I mean, it sounds like we use the same term, but I should think it meant something different. In a film with no talking versus a film with talking. Barbara, I wonder if you can just enlighten us on the work of screenwriters when we're talking about such drastically different kinds of films.
Right, well, there still needed to be a screenplay that actors could go from. And we look at Jean Gontier. I really want to mention her. We have her in the book in 1907, and she was a multitasker also, but in this particular instance, we look at her writing the first screenplay adaptation for Ben-Hur, right back then, and it took her 2 days to do it. So we have to know that the films back then were much shorter, but the screenplays needed to be written, even though it wasn't the dialogue so much, it was the action. So that's what had to be written then. And then also, you know, in silent movies, there's the cards that have to come up to explain the different things along the way so we know more about what's going on. So there were writers for those cards, too. That was a specialty in that time, to be able to write those cards.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm so glad you're highlighting that, because that's exactly the kind of thing that even if we take the time to watch a silent film, as you know, not enough of us do, that is an aspect of it that we tend to completely take for granted, as though those cards write themselves. And in fact, it's really important that those be done very, very well.
Right. So that was a whole talent of the time too.
I wonder, before we leave the silent film era, if we could be sure to talk about a woman by the name of Florence Lawrence. She was an actress, one of a number of actresses from this era that you talk about, in addition to the famous names, the Mary Pickfords and the Lillian Gishes and so on, there are others who are highlighted, even though they are largely forgotten today. But Florence Lawrence should not be forgotten, because she has a really important distinction as being the first film actress to be identified by her name. Explain to our listeners the significance of this, because this on the face of it might seem absurd. Of course,
right,
Actresses would be known by their name, but in fact, that wasn't the case at first.
No, in the early years, there weren't movie stars. There were just people who appeared in movies, and they were on the screen. They were doing actions. They were doing whatever, but they weren't identified. But Florence Lawrence became the first movie star, and then her name was divulged to the public. So that was the start of the cult, shall we call it, of having fame and renown from being in the movies. She was the first whose name was made public.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jill Titchen and Barbara Bridges about Hollywood, Her Story, an illustrated history of women and the movies. A phrase we see quite a lot in the book as we read about these various actresses, we'll read the words, "She was not able to make the transition to talkies." And I think a lot of us understand that about about actors and actresses, that some made that transition and for others it was simply too difficult or too intimidating, or that for one reason or another it just didn't happen and essentially their careers came to an end. What we've already touched on is the fact that there was also with the advent of the talkies and the advent of major studios, that also for many women who had been so involved in so many aspects of film, suddenly things became much more difficult. Just how drastic a change are we talking about in terms of the number of women directly involved in the film industry? Just how precipitous a drop are we talking about?
The creation of the studio system really changed a lot. It was a drastic change. This is when it was the end of the 20s, and it was the talkies that started, and money really became the movies became very lucrative. And so that attracted the men, and it's a sign of the times, too. That's the way things worked at the end of the 20s also, that the men started controlling the studios, and women were pushed out of so many areas of filmmaking. But I want to also say that they weren't pushed out of all areas of filmmaking, because there were areas that were acceptable for women to stay in, such as costume design, hair and makeup, those kinds of things. So we see women really flourishing during the studio system in those areas. But in other areas, it was the men who took over. They took over the studios. Women didn't have their studios any longer, for the most part. The smaller studios went away. So it really became the studio system.
Mm. Tell us about this woman named Dorothy Arzner, who managed to be one of just a tiny handful of women who continued to direct during this era when it was all but unheard of. Tell us more about Dorothy Arzner.
Well, Dorothy Arzner was the only woman director who did make the transition from silent films to talkies. She was the first woman to be given a screen credit as an editor, the first woman to join the Directors Guild of America, and in a fascinating little tidbit, she invented the boom microphone when she had her crew attach a microphone to a fishing rod and then to use it on the set. But since she didn't file a patent for it, she doesn't get necessarily the credit as the inventor.
So. Among some of the other interesting women, and now we're into the 1930s, the era of the talkies, Technicolor, the Great Depression, of course, it's interesting to read about, for instance, somebody like Kay Brown Barnett, who was apparently one of the most important talent scouts and eventually became an agent. And sometimes when one thinks about the film industry, we kind of forget the really, really crucial role that talent scouts and agents could play, and apparently this was also an area of the film industry in which a skilled woman could carve out an enviable place of importance.
And what Kay Brown Barrett actually did is she convinced David Selznick to film Gone with the Wind. He didn't want to do it. She was an amazing woman. We show her in 1936. And this is a total side note, but just part of putting this book together, I actually talked to her daughter to get this picture of her that's in the book. And so we were just so happy to find out about her, and I'll let Barbara talk a little bit more about some of the things that she did and some of the things she was responsible for.
Please.
Well, first I want to mention that whenever we wrote this book, we didn't know how many different categories there would be in filmmaking. And what is it, Joe, that we have 26?
26, I think.
26 yeah. different categories. And so we don't have a lot in this particular category. Every woman in the book has an icon that shows whether she's an actress or she can have more than one icon, of course, the way we talked about the multitasking. But there's not a lot in this book who is a talent scout, as you mentioned. So, as Jill said, she's remembered for bringing Gone with the Wind to Daniel Selznick. So that's a very big part of filmmaking there.
Right. I mean, for that alone, she deserves a special mention in film history. I was also intrigued from the same chapter to read about a woman named Margaret Booth, who you tell us was supervising editor at MGM from 1937 to 1964. And you tell us that she had to approve every film before it left the studio. I mean, it's like the buck stops here. It has to go through the hands of Margaret Booth before a film is deemed ready for release to the public. I mean, that's an enormous responsibility. And that was the responsibility of Margaret Booth at a place as important as MGM.
Right. And what it says at MGM was, I mean, she was there from 1937 to 1964. So there were women in place. Barbara has told me a fascinating quote that is, the past is not the same as history. And what we are doing is helping history restore the narrative of including more of that real past. So like Margaret Booth, like Kay Brown Barrett, we're actually making sure that these women's contributions to the film industry, which were significant, are actually memorialized and recognized.
Right. And I appreciate the fact that you are telling us about their contributions within the context of film history itself. Before we finish, tell us something about, and we should certainly make sure people understand that your sprawling, wonderful, beautiful book takes us all the way up to the present day, when, of course, this issue is still very much before us about the place of women in the film industry and the ways in which gifted, capable women are still being, in some respects, marginalized or excluded from certain opportunities. How would you chart the recovery that women managed to make overall in the film industry over the last several decades? I mean, from those early times when they were shunted from so many opportunities, that eventually began to change. When did it change, and in what significant ways?
Well, I would say that it continues to change, and women continue to try to regain all of the roles that they played at the beginning of filmmaking. And they do some of the same kinds of things that the early filmmakers did, and that's multitasking. When we see Jane Fonda in her 40s say, I was trained to be an actress. That's what I thought I was going to do. But then I find that if I want to make the movies that I want to make, that I have to be learning all of the different parts of filmmaking so I can make those movies. I have to learn to be a producer. We see so many actresses forming their own production companies and making the movies that they want to make. I think that if you want to see really the changes, you can look at the Oscars on our website, HollywoodHerStory.com. We have a part in there that's called Oscars. And we have listings of the awards by year and by category. And you can see by year that every year or every decade, there's more and more women being nominated for these awards. And you can see by category the areas that they're still struggling to be noted for. Mm. So in this last Oscars, there were 10 categories that included women as winners of Oscars. Then there were 8 other categories where they were nominated and didn't win. But there were 4 categories where there were no nominations for women. And that's where they still struggle. And I'll say specifically best cinematography. There's only been one woman in the whole 92 years of the Oscars that has ever been nominated for that category. So we see best director. Five women have been nominated over the history of the Oscars for that category. So I think that the Oscars are a good indication to show that women flourish in the areas that, like I told you, best costume design, best hair and makeup. So we can see that reflected in the Oscars as well.
Well, you've done an amazing job of telling this rich and complex story. And I must say that the book is not only packed full of information, but also beautifully laid out. I mean, it's a work of art in terms of the rich array of photographs that are included and the beautiful way that they are positioned on the page. And altogether, it tells this story in really commendable fashion. The book, again, is titled Hollywood, Her Story, An Illustrated History of Women and the Movies, published by Lions Press, which is a division of Roman Littlefield, and the co-authors Jill Teigen and Barbara Bridges. Jill Teigen and Barbara Bridges, I thank you so much, first of all, for bringing this amazing book to the public, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was really fun to talk with you.
Thank you.
And the time is 8:56 here on WGTD. We're going to finish out the hour with some beautiful music from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The King and I Have Dreamed. This is one of the pieces that is to be sung tomorrow night at Reuther High School Auditorium, 7:30, the concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra devoted to Golden Age Broadway music. The concert at this point is still on, and this is one of the gorgeous pieces that will be part of that evening. This is actually John Williams' arrangement of I Have Dreamed, played by the Boston Pops Orchestra.